to episode 13 of All Crime No Cattle, a Texas true crime podcast. I'm Erin, and I'm sitting next to my beautiful, gorgeous, hilarious current husband, Shay. Introduce yourself, Shay.
I'd like to be introduced as Detective Shaw.
I know you, some of us may know you as Shea Butter.
Yeah, that's true.
Because I think that makes more sense.
No, I'm Shay, and I don't like being called the current husband. That makes me feel like you're going to murder me at some point and try and
cover it up.
True Crime Posse, if I go missing and you don't hear from us, look into it. Erin did it.
You'll never catch me.
Do you have any upkeep to do this episode? Anything to mention?
No, we're perfect and we have no corrections. The ACNC canine unit is quiet and chill.
For
once. So that's
once.
A first.
Yeah.
I don't expect it to last, but we'll see what happens.
Well, anyways, are you ready to get into it?
I am so ready.
All right. Well, this week's episode, episode 13, is called College Town Death in Bryan, Texas. And this is the case of Jenna Verhollen. First, I'll start off by talking a little bit about our sources for this case. I used a lot of articles that came out from the local news channel, KBTX TV Channel 3. That's the local Bryan, Texas news station. They put out several articles during the entirety of this case, from the beginning to the end. A lot of them, like in most small town news articles, you've probably seen this, Erin, they're little snippets, you know, little updates, little paragraphs. There's not an in-depth go-to article from this local newspaper. And we'll get more into KBTX's coverage later. I also used an article from The Eagle, which is a local Bryan College Station news and sports website dedicated to the area's college activities and student activities as well as sports. They actually did some interesting investigations on this case. I used some of the information that was obtained through Crime Stoppers as well as the TexAg student forums, which are an active kind of MySpace, Facebook type social networking site just for A&M students in College Station.
Oh.
And the main source for this story actually comes to us from Forensic Files.
Ooh.
Yeah, and it comes from season 14, episode 13, called Low Maintenance. It aired in January of 2011. So let's talk about the setting of this crime. So we're talking about an area that we haven't discussed yet in Texas. We're talking about Bryan College Station. Now, a lot of people, when they hear that name, they think Bryan College Station is one place. Actually, Bryan and College Station are two different places. They're like twin cities, kind of like Dallas and Fort Worth, but on a smaller scale. Our story actually starts off in Bryan, Texas, which is a little bit to the northwest of College Station. Bryan, Texas's town slogan is "The Good Life, Texas Style."
Oh, God.
Yeah. When you talk to the students of A&M versus some of the smaller colleges that are in Bryan, there's a lot of animosity between College Station and Bryan, Texas. Bryan's where, like, the commuter junior college schools are. College Station is where the big university is. So when we talk about these two towns, there's kind of this rumor, this idea between people from Bryan and people from College Station, you know, because College Station is where a big university is. And Bryan, Texas is a kind of a suburb satellite city of College Station. It's where a bunch of junior colleges are. If you ask people, Bryan's a dangerous town that's slummy and has, you know, violent, murderous activity. There's not a lot of numbers to back that up. This is just kind of a rumor on social media and amongst students between
these schools.
Oh, it's
just those mean A&M kids, huh?
Apparently. And yeah, we're going to get into that. Bryan actually has a population of 83,000 people. It is the county seat of Brazos County. It's located in the heart of the Brazos Valley in southeast central Texas. If you make a triangle by connecting the dots of DFW to Austin and over to Houston, so you got that Austin to Houston to DFW triangle, Bryan sits almost smack center in the middle of that triangle of space.
Okay.
Yeah. Bryan is probably most known for being the town just to the northwest of College Station, like we talked about. College Station should ring a bell, like you mentioned, Erin, because it is the home of a giant university, A&M. Together, these two cities make up what is known as the Bryan College Station metropolitan area. This large metroplex has a population of around 250,000 people, so it's pretty big. It's not as big as DFW, but it's a decent-sized metropolitan area. You want some fun facts about Brian?
Oh, I do.
Yeah. Brian is home to one of the fourth largest chicken and poultry empires in North America, Sanderson Farms.
Oh, I was going to say Tyson.
Nope, not Tyson.
Oh, it don't got Tyson on it.
No, it don't. Brian holds the world record for the largest edible gingerbread house ever made.
In the world?
In the world.
No.
It's Guinness Book certified. Yeah, I actually have a video about the giant gingerbread house, which I'm probably going to save from the local news.
Is it life-size?
It's huge. Yeah, it's like a real-size home.
Wow.
And you can go inside of it, and it has like windows and doors and everything.
How long would it take me to eat that entire thing, you think?
Oh, years. It's massive.
24 hours.
Plus, you got to remember, gingerbread gets real hard when you make... Have you ever had a gingerbread house? You can't eat them afterwards. They're like concrete.
I'm pretty sure I could eat one. Okay. It's the only thing I'm known for is my eating skills, so pretty sure I could do it. Are we just trying to one-up each other on weird facts about weird Texas towns at this point?
So that's my fun facts. Nally, you ready to get into the actual case?
I am.
Do you feel like you know Bryan, Texas?
I feel like I'm there.
Great.
I'm assuming it's named after some dude named, like, Bryan Smith.
It's actually named after one of Sam Houston's cousins. I looked that up too. It wasn't a fun fact, but it does have close ties
to... It's not very fun.
Yeah, it has close ties to a land grant that was given to the Sam Houston family.
Ugh, yeah. Snooze. Okay.
Gosh.
Let's move on.
So let's talk a little bit about Jennifer Holland. She's a 20-year-old student who is studying for a career in law and government at Blinn Junior College in Bryan, Texas. Now, Blinn Junior College is a small feeder college for A&M University. It kind of works in the same way. Do you remember when we were going to UT Arlington and there was a program there? If you were going to transfer to UT Austin, you could go through this kind of preparatory transfer program to eventually go to UT proper in Austin.
Okay.
Similar idea with Bryan, Texas and Blinn College. It's a big deal for their junior college, and I haven't seen this written anywhere, but it sounds like to me from the courses that Jenna was taking at the time that she was planning to move on to A&M at a later date because they are very well known for their law school. It actually ranks as the 40th best law school in the country.
A&M?
Yes.
What, is that what she was going to school for? Was for law?
Yeah. She's going through and studying for a career in law and government. Jenna was known by family and friends to be a person everyone got along with. She was a loyal friend, a loving daughter, a hardworking and intelligent student, and somebody with a very bright future. She and her longtime boyfriend, Spencer Hood, not only had similar degrees, but they also had the same kind of career plans in mind, but they also had separate apartments at the same apartment complex, Autumn Woods. Autumn Woods is an apartment complex that is right next to Blinn College, where they both attended classes. Today, these apartments have been renamed to College Edge Student Housing at Bryan. And it looks like that they've been incorporated into a campus housing program since they are so conveniently located literally right next to the campus. These apartments differed from other low-end student efficiency apartments in the area. They're actually really nice. They're also set up for students to have lots of areas where they could let loose and do activities. They have a big pool, hot tubs, a basketball court, a sand volleyball court, an area to play horseshoes, a party pavilion with barbecues, and Jenna could leave her apartment and walk about 200 feet and be in the campus parking lot. Jenna was also working her way through school and perhaps able to afford her apartment in this nice apartment complex by working as a full-time waitress at a local restaurant called Wings and More in nearby College Station. Wings and More is your typical college town sports bar and restaurant. It's very busy and probably catered to a lot of A&M students. Employees there and her supervisors knew her as a great worker and a friend to almost anyone who worked there. Very reliable, generally an awesome person.
So what's the and more of Wings and More?
I think it's like your typical sports bar. So like, what would the and more be?
Just beer? Why wouldn't it just be wings and beer?
Wings and beer. That does sound better than more. You remember that place that was right near...
Lampshades, Gifts, and More.
You knew exactly where I was going. Lampshades, Gifts, and more.
What more could you want other than lampshades and gifts?
I love how generic... Lampshades, Gifts, and More is, especially when it comes to the gifts part, it wasn't generic enough that they had to go with the more.
Yeah, exactly. I love that they're excluding lampshades as a proper gift. Like, you can't give a lampshade as a gift, but if you want a lampshade and you need a gift.
I love a good lampshade.
And then also you need some maxi pads and hair gel, because it's and more. It's things that cannot be lampshades. You can't put it on a lamp. You can't give it as a present. But if you need shoelaces and maxi pads and hair gel.
And gum.
It's basically Walmart.
But with lampshades and gifts.
Walmart has those things. Why do you exist, lampshades, gifts, and more?
All right, so let's get into this case properly. So Thursday, April 9th, 2008, Jenna's boyfriend, Spencer, has just finished up his morning's classes. This happens around 10 a.m. in the morning, okay? He then decides to head over to Jenna's apartment to pick up a book that he supposedly left there. He arrived at Jenna's apartment and noticed that the door was actually unlocked, and so he continued to go inside. Shortly after, Spencer said he found Jenna in her bedroom, lying on her back. She was not responding, and he ran to a neighbor next door and was able to get them to assist him by having them call 911. The neighbor spoke with the dispatcher over the phone as Spencer stayed with Jenna, hoping to provide some sort of aid to her. In the following 911 call, we can hear exactly what transpired. You ready?
So is this officially our first 911 call of the show?
I believe it is.
Oh, I'm nervous. Okay.
She's just laying on the ground. Unconscious and she's not breathing.
Okay. Can you touch her and see if she's warm to the touch?
Can you touch her and see if she's warm to the touch? She's cold.
She's cold to the touch?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, my God.
So what you hear there is the neighbor talking to the dispatcher. The person in the background is Spencer. And so you hear the neighbor telling Spencer, touch her and see if she's cold to the touch. And he yells back, she's cold. She's cold to the touch. And, you know, as it goes on, you hear Spencer in the background saying, oh, my God, I guess in realization that she's dead. Jenna was pronounced dead at the scene just a few moments later when the paramedics do arrive. Investigators found very little in the way of evidence at the scene once they get there. Jenna had bitten her tongue with her teeth at some point, and she also had a small bruise over her left eye. Other than that, there were no signs of what actually happened to Jenna. Detectives Lance Matthews and Stephen Fry are assigned to the case, and they began working the crime scene. They almost immediately wrote off the motive of robbery. This is because of some glaring issues, one of which was nothing appeared to be taken. There were appliances, jewelry, electronics, other valuables that were all still seemingly left in their respective places in Jenna's apartment. Surprisingly, Jenna's purse was hanging by a hook on the door where she was known to leave it for convenience. Inside her purse was money, credit cards, and even her car keys. Detectives Fry and Matthews noted that there were no medications, drugs, or alcohol in the home either, and quickly ruled out suicide as a cause of death. They kind of commented that Jenna's apartment was very meager. You know, it looked like everything that she had in her apartment she really worked for and cared for, and it was a very clean, organized college student's apartment. During the autopsy, the medical examiner Mark Krause made a couple of interesting discoveries. The findings could not show any evidence that Jenna had been sexually assaulted. Dr. Krause was quick to point out in his interviews with Forensic Files, quote, that the lack of genital injuries do not rule out a sexual assault. What Dr. Krause did discover were small broken vessels in Jenna's sclera, the white of her eye. These are known as petechial hemorrhages.
I was about to say petechial hemorrhages.
Oh, do you know about these? Because yeah. I didn't. And so this was like a fun rabbit hole for me to go down. And so I guess I'll tell the audience about it a little bit about what I found.
Yeah, go ahead. But if you know, if you're a true crime aficionado, you know about petechial hemorrhaging.
No. Ooh, well, maybe I'm showing my cards a little bit.
Oh, no.
I'm an audio engineer at heart. Dr. Krause explained that petechial hemorrhages are in the constellation of findings that we refer to as stigmata of asphyxiation. So I went on, like I said, a little search about what petechial hemorrhages are and what stigmata of asphyxiation is. Because Forensic Files, we can talk about this a little bit. They're great for what they are, but they're really short, you know, including commercials, they're like 20 minutes. So they don't include a lot of information. So they mention, you know, this broken blood vessels in Jenna's sclera, and then they move right on. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? Why is that significant? Well, let me tell you. So when I did some further digging into the concept of petechial hemorrhages to figure out exactly why this means someone has asphyxiated, what I found was pretty interesting. What's happening here is that your eyes have blood vessels in them that allow blood to flow through the sclera of your eye. This typically happens normally as your heart is pumping blood throughout your body. However, when someone is asphyxiated, the blood in the eye is not allowed to flow properly, and pressure starts to build up in these blood vessels until they actually rupture. Now, some people may be familiar with normal body decomposition and blood vessel rupturing in a body postmortem, because this is a common occurrence, and the main difference is this usually takes a lot more time to happen, as you need the blood vessels themselves to fully decay and fall apart in the eye after death. That's why if you've seen some crime scene photos of pictures of people that are in postmortem, sometimes all of the whites of their eyes have become red and really full of blood. They're flushed with red. That's because all of their blood vessels have fallen apart. And this is something that I know I've noticed because it freaks me out and I don't like it and it creeps me out. And I'm like, why are their eyes red? That's nasty. So this is much harder to pinpoint. In cases of asphyxia, like Jenna's case, these petechial hemorrhages can be extremely small and they're often overlooked by medical examiners. We're talking about sizes that range from a speck of dust to 2 millimeters. So they're really tiny.
Yeah, and like you said, they have specifically to do with strangulation, I believe, as opposed to other forms of suffocation, because it has to do, like you said, with the pressure that's put on those blood vessels, because the blood cannot physically be released from those areas because everything's kind of caught up. It's kind of choked up in the neck. So you have none of the blood can go down into the rest of the body like what would normally happen. So I think it's different. And of course, I'm not, you know, an expert or anything, but I know that it's different from strangulation versus a choking, let's say like choking on a foreign object or whatever, versus even being hanged. There's ways that they can kind of figure those things out based on petechial hemorrhaging, because
Petechial hemorrhaging in people that have been hung.
It happens there as well. But you also think there's a difference between being hung and then being choked. But I don't know the exact details.
You also see it in people who have been smothered with a pillow. But I thought this was interesting information. So upon discovering these telltale signs, the medical examiner knew that he needed to do some further investigating and find some more evidence of what actually caused Jenna's asphyxiation.
So there's petechial hemorrhaging of the eyes, but there's no bruising or any kind of marks on the neck at all?
No, which is strange because that's one of my questions that I had, but she didn't have any neck bruising. And I would think you would have some kind of bruising on the neck where you'd been choked, because we've seen that before in other cases.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dr. Krause found his answer when he examined Jenna's larynx. He found that it had been completely crushed. Dr. Krause said, this is a strangulation, and in great probability, manual strangulation by the hands. So I'm not sure how you can crush someone's larynx without leaving bruising, but somehow the perpetrator did. And this is a good example of why I would have liked to had a Freedom of Information Act filed and gotten the police files to actually look at some of the medical examiner's full reports on this case. And Aaron and I have talked about this a little bit outside the episode. I think I'm going to go ahead and file that Freedom of Information Act request and see if I can get those full documents and give some bonus information and some follow-ups to this episode once we do get those full reports. I think that could be really interesting, especially for some stuff that we're going to talk about later in this episode.
The only thing that I can think of, again, as a complete non-expert and just giving out my random opinion, but the only thing I can think of is whatever happened to her, she died really quickly and there wasn't time for the blood to be released into the skin to cause the bruising. That's the only thing I could think of. Just basically knowing that and not knowing any other further details. So her larynx was crushed. Was there damage to the hyoid bone?
That is not mentioned. I'd like to know that, but that's something we can look for once we get the full report.
Yeah.
So this, as we know, is a very terrible and personal way to kill someone, manual strangulation. We've talked about this a little bit before. It often takes significant time and effort to accomplish. Judging from the way that her body was found, she was lying on her back, and from the damage to her larynx, it is safe to assume that Jenna's killer was on top of her with his hands around her neck and most likely locked eye to eye with her when he finally killed her. So finally, investigators, they had something to go on in Jenna's case once they got this report back. They now knew at some point she had been strangled to death. This mixed with the unforced entry, the lack of evidence for sexual assault, no apparent robbery, it kind of clouded the other evidence that was going on in the apartment because they just didn't have a lot to go on. But they at least knew that there was a homicide now. This opened up a lot of options for detectives to start doing a community casing, to question tons of people in the apartment complex, to go in and start looking at, you know, forensics and that kind of stuff. So yeah, and detectives at this point are also beginning to wonder if this could be a crime of passion, maybe revenge. You know, they're going to start looking at the closest people, you know, her boyfriend, past boyfriends, people from school, that kind of thing. Detectives had the surveillance tapes pulled from Jenna's work at Wings and More. There didn't appear to be anything unusual on the recordings. They showed Jenna clocking in and out of her office, waiting tables, and leaving the restaurant after her shift. Cameras in the parking lot even showed Jenna walking to her car safely, and there's a big wide view, and you can't see anyone that's appearing to follow her or case her or anything like that. Investigators started looking at people close to Jenna. Their number one suspect, as we said, was of course her longtime boyfriend, Spencer Hood. So let's talk a little bit about Spencer Hood. Authorities were able to determine that Spencer and Jenna had broken up several times over the past years, since they had first began seeing each other in high school. A couple of times they even began seeing other people in between breakups, but always kind of found a way to mend their differences and get back together. Police are kind of wondering, you know, Detectives Matthews and Fry, is this kind of like a scorned lover situation? Did Jenna try and break up with Spencer Wood one final time and he just couldn't take it and he's trying to cover this up? So they asked Spencer to come in for some questioning. Detectives Fry and Matthews, they're trying to ask him some general clarification questions about what might have happened to Jenna, or perhaps see if his initial statement to the paramedics and detectives on the scene stays consistent. When the detectives asked Spencer if he had anything to do with Jenna's death, he had a very straightforward answer that was absolutely not. Spencer had seen Jenna recently on the night just prior to her eventual death and was the first one to find her. He went on to say that after Jenna got done with her work shift, they met at her apartment at 9:30 p.m. This is April 8th, not the 9th. He said that they spent about 3 hours studying together, and then after that, the two of them finished up their studies, and he said that he left Jenna's apartment around 12 a.m. He also told police that he later called Jenna, maybe around 12:30 a.m., to tell her goodnight from his apartment. The phone records show that Spencer placed a call to Jenna Verhollen's apartment at 12:47 a.m. The next time Spencer saw Jenna was when he discovered her body in her apartment less than 12 hours later. Right then, police are looking at about a 12-hour window.
So when he called her at 12:47, she answered and they had an actual phone conversation?
It's very short, the call.
Okay,
it's,
but she did answer. Yes. Okay, mm-hmm. So we know that it's sometime between 12:47 and 10 or so when he placed the call to 911.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's less than 12-hour window we're talking about.
Yeah. Okay. Question, though. She and Spencer, were they, I know they were on again, off again during their kind of high school, early college careers. Were they on again or off again at the time of her death?
By all reports from their friends, they were on again.
Okay.
You ready to move on to a second major suspect in this case that was discovered the same night of the event?
Yes.
The reason why I brought up all the outdoor activities at the apartment was there were a bunch of people taking advantage of these outdoor activities during the weeknight of a Wednesday night, because it's college kids, you know.
Yeah, and I'm sure we're talking about kids that not only live in that apartment complex, but also friends of friends of friends. So you exactly. have a ton of people hanging out in an area who might not actually have connections there. So how are you going to track them down?
Yeah. So you got a bunch of people out playing some sand volleyball and having some beers at this sand volleyball court not too far from Jenna's apartment. several of these neighbors who were taking part in the sand volleyball saw a shirtless man walking from the direction of Jenna's apartment at Autumn Woods and continued past the volleyball courts. The group remembered this man specifically because he sort of came out of nowhere without a shirt, and he was really upset. He was physically angry. He was kind of talking to himself. He looked irrational. Some of the women said that he looked at them and that he looked really scary.
What did, was he carrying anything in his hands?
Nope. He had nothing but his, some wind pants on.
Okay. So if this was the person who attacked Jenna and maybe his shirt got bloodied or like cut up or whatever during the attack, he took it off. So what, where did the shirt go? Or is this just some weirdo walking around campus without a shirt on? That's not the weirdest thing I've ever heard.
Those were all the questions that detectives had. And this was one of the better leads that they got.
It's definitely suspicious for sure.
Yeah. So some of the
What time was it when they saw this guy?
This is after midnight. They're not really sure what time it was, but they were out late drinking beer and playing sand volleyball when they saw this guy sometime after midnight.
Sounds fun.
Yeah.
The volleyball, not weird shirtless man.
Okay. So some of the witnesses told investigators the man resembled someone that they knew from the apartment complex who also went to Blinn College, and his name was Sean Stevens. Sean Stevens was a 26-year-old. Like I said, he went to Blinn College, but he was connected to Jenna in another way. So apparently he and Jenna had crossed paths before, and police questioned some of Jenna's friends about Sean Stevens, and they found out that there was an occasion where Sean had yelled from his balcony down to Jenna and some of her friends, specifically at Jenna, and yelled a big spree of vulgar catcalling remarks at her. Some of them claimed he was obsessed with Jenna. So there's kind of a stalkery, you know, kind of vibe coming from this guy.
And is there additional information, like how they knew each other, what his deal was with her?
Well, it's an important fact to bring up at this point that Sean's apartment had an unobscured view directly at Jenna's apartment.
Oh, that's never good.
Yeah.
In fact, I feel like I can recall many forensic files where the perpetrator had an unobstructed view into another person's home.
Yeah, it leads to that like obsession, you know, where they're just like watching
you. It's like rear window, yeah. But instead of it being like a laid up person just being weird at their window, it's like just a creepy serial killer murder type situation.
Yeah. And, you know, detectives went to both of their apartments and they did some kind of general testing, and they determined that Sean would have been able to tell if Jenna was coming and going from the apartment, if someone had arrived at Jenna's apartment, what kind of by the silhouettes of the lights that were on, what generally what was going on in the living room, or, you know, things like that, that he could also tell when she, her routines, and if she turned off the lights to go to bed.
Did the friends know why he, I mean, if he's yelling all these expletives and vulgar things at her, did, I mean, there had to be a reason. Was there like a, some kind of conflict between them, or so nobody knew. They just nobody knew really that this knew. Was a very weird guy who yelled a bunch of things
yes.
at her at
and
least
that
one time.
He was generally kind of obsessed with her.
And was Jenna, did she ever talk about being afraid of him yes. or anything like that? Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah. Okay. I can definitely tell why this guy's a suspect.
So detective,
or a person of interest at the very mm-hmm. least.
Well, Detectives Fry and Matthews, they go ahead and name him a suspect, like in their own notes. They haven't really announced to the public who they're looking into, but they definitely mark Sean down for some formal questioning, and they bring him in. Sean is extremely nervous. He's physically shaking during the interview. He told officers he didn't have anything to do with Jenna's death and said that he was not whoever this shirtless man was that the neighbors saw playing volleyball. Unfortunately for Sean, though, and also for the detectives, he could not account for where and what he was doing around the time of this incident because he was extremely drunk and intoxicated. He didn't remember walking by the volleyball courts. He couldn't even tell what apartment he was in the apartment complex. So, great alibi, Sean.
Is he claiming he was completely wasted
yes.
alone?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so pretty sketchy alibi.
Very sketch.
Yeah. Let's talk about the due diligence of these detectives. So we already have two major people of interest in this case that have been brought in for questioning. But investigators didn't stop there. They went ahead and interviewed over 200 people in this apartment complex with formal interviews. And they started broadening their search for any other possible suspects, even though they had already talked to Sean and Spencer at this point. So they found out a few months prior to Jenna's death, she had informed her family that something really strange and startling had happened in her apartment. She was taking a shower one morning, and after she finished, she got out and she discovered that the apartment maintenance man was just standing in her living room. Yeah, the maintenance man claimed he found the apartment unlocked and just went in to get things set up for some work. He also claimed that he hadn't heard the water running from the shower and didn't realize anyone was actually home. He quickly gathered up his things and just left.
Okay, was there any documentation to show that this maintenance man had reason to go into her apartment that day?
We'll get into that here in just a second, but
okay.
What is your initial reaction to how you would feel coming out of the shower and just seeing an unannounced, unplanned maintenance worker that Jenna had not asked for right there?
You know, it really depends on where you live, because we've lived in places where nary a maintenance man could be found. You mm-hmm. could your walls could be falling down around you and a maintenance man would never, ever come.
Or in our case, full of bees. Yes. That happened to
us. I literally got stung on the butt by a bee because our entire wall was made of bees. Never came. I think we dealt with it ourselves. I think we just got a can of bee spray and just sprayed it down. But anyway, so at a place like that, and I saw just a maintenance man in my house, that would be very disturbing. However, we lived in an apartment complex in Arlington. This is just before we moved to Fort Worth. And we had maintenance men that came through almost every day, it seemed like. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was always something that they were doing, whether it was checking like the fire stops in and above the stove area, if they were checking the filters, if they were checking for light bulbs. I mean, they seem to be coming in all the time. And so if in that case, if I was in the bathroom, whatever, and came out and saw a maintenance man again, I would feel uncomfortable, but I wouldn't be necessarily like shocked or horrified. I would just be like, oh, hey, guy, what are you doing here? Well, I mean, it kind of depends on where, on what their situation was at those apartments.
And a big difference in our case was we had a good working relationship with our maintenance men, and they were super handy and super helpful, and they helped us out of a lot of spots. So we're not trying to admonish our maintenance men where we lived, because they were awesome, but they were a little aggressive in like the maintenance and upkeep.
They were a little too free with that master key.
Well, and so there's something else that we need to talk about is like, does this maintenance man have a master key that opens any apartment in the apartment complex?
Well, I would assume he would.
Or is it just specific apartment keys? Because sometimes the apartment complex will have a wall of specific keys for each apartment and the maintenance men have to check it out.
So, interesting. Okay.
So Jenna was not expecting this particular maintenance man in her apartment. She hadn't called for any regular maintenance and she hadn't contacted the management office to request for any repairs. She was very shaken by this experience, obviously, because she was scared enough to call her family and say, hey, this weird thing happened. I'm kind of freaked out. What should I do?
God, this poor woman. She has this creepoid living across from her who's screaming at her and staring at her into her apartment. And then she has this maintenance man who's just waltzing in whenever he feels like it.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
poor
man.
Jenna. The name of this particular employee was Jeremy Rosser. He didn't have a record. He was divorced and he's a working dad with two kids. He'd been working at Autumn Woods for about 16 months, and he was 27 at the time and had never applied to attend Blinn College. So his only connection to Jenna is purely through a few routine maintenance jobs that he had done previously at her apartment in this particular instance that we're talking about. So one of the first things that Detectives Fry and Matthews did after discovering information about this particular incident with the maintenance man, they went back to Jenna's apartment. One of them stood at Jenna's front door entryway, and the other went into Jenna's bathroom and went ahead and shut the door. They then turned on the shower, and the detective at the front entryway could, in fact, hear the shower running. both Detectives Fry and Matthews went on to say it was very clear that anyone who would have been in that entryway would have known that someone was in the shower taking a shower. So if that was Jeremy Rosser's claim that he just came in and he didn't know anybody was home and didn't realize someone was in the shower, that's an outright lie. It's also important to discuss at this point that 1 week after Jenna's death, Jeremy Rosser just stopped showing up for work.
Ooh, that's a red flag.
And Autumn Woods went ahead and decided to terminate his employment after he just stopped showing up. This is the point where I'm going to open the floor for you as Detective Aaron to kind of make your observations about these three major suspects and tell me what you would do in this investigation and kind of where you would point your primary suspect. Is it A, scorned on and off again, love Spencer Hood, or possibly the potential stalker situation of Sean Stevens, who lives across the way, or the creepy maintenance guy, Jeremy Rosser?
Well, just going off of what we know so far, I would say that, in my opinion, the least likely candidate is the maintenance man. Although the fact that he quit a week later is very suspect.
Well, let me add a little piece of information there. Okay. He was actively going through his divorce right at that time.
Oh, okay. And then maybe like this happened and he's just like, I can't deal with this. I'm just quitting this job and I'm going to go do something else. So I can kind of understand him and him being there a little bit more than the others. I can see him realizing as soon as he gets into like the middle of the living room, oh crap, there's somebody in the shower, because she opens the door and he's just like, ah, and it being very awkward. And then he's going through all this stuff. Yeah. But I feel like there's for him, there's, you know, again, I always try to go with Occam's razor. And I think there's a very simple explanation, which is he just like messed up and he was just in there and felt as weird about it as she did and kind of ran out. And for me, if I'm thinking of the three, again, Occam's razor, he's the least likely, in my opinion, to have done this. Between the other two, though, it's kind of a toss-up to me. Okay, so this is a crime where there's no entry. So we know that obviously she would have let her boyfriend in the apartment. Now, it seems like this creepy guy she wouldn't have let in because she obviously had some kind of interaction with him that she felt there was a negative aspect to it. So
you're talking about Sean Stevens, the creepy stalker guy?
Yeah, the creepy neighbor. So I don't think that she would have necessarily let him in, but I don't know, some people, if there's somebody at the door and you at least you kind of recognize them, you might open the door to them not even thinking anything about it, thinking,
being like, hey, what do you want, go away, and then somehow he gets
and then
in.
He just kind of muscles his way in. Yeah. So,
and you know, he did say he was close to blackout drunk. Maybe he's drunk.
Exactly. Just because there's not a robbery or anything taken from the home, again, that doesn't really point to either one of them. The person who finds the body and makes the 911 call is always going to be suspicious to me.
Okay, so you're talking about Spencer
Hood. I'm talking about the boyfriend. Mm-hmm. That's always going to be very suspicious.
Statistically, but you're not wrong.
Exactly. And, you know, if you're talking about a murder, especially a very personal, passionate murder that is manual strangulation, the closest person to that person is the most likely candidate. And again, that would be her boyfriend.
Okay. Is that where you're resting your laurels? Putting all your eggs in that basket?
I'm going to say it's the neighbor, just because they had an on again, off again relationship. From what you said, there hasn't been any sort of violence or any kind of negativity in the relationship that would make it seem like this boyfriend was capable of something like this. And I think probably what happened was the boyfriend left that night. This creepy neighbor guy had seen the boyfriend leave and he was pissed drunk, went over there to maybe talk to her or whatever, and ended up killing her.
All right. Well, we'll go with that for now and we'll see how it pans
out. Okay. Well, that's what Inspector Aaron says.
All right. Stamp of approval. Inspector Aaron.
Yeah. Arrest him.
So we're going to jump back to when police figured out about the incident with the maintenance man.
Okay.
They actually go to question Jeremy Rosser, just like they had questioned Sean and Spencer Hood. But soon after losing his job and beginning the initial processes of his divorce, Jeremy Rosser skipped town. No one knew where he was or where he had gone. Now, detectives are hit with another blow to their investigation when Spencer Hood and Sean Stevens all go missing.
What?
Yeah. These two haven't been seen at school. They haven't been seen in and around their apartment complex where they live. And they basically just vanish off the face of the earth.
The boyfriend and the neighbor.
Yes. All three of them tell no one where they're going, what they're doing, and just leave town.
What? Do they just go on a boys' trip?
Maybe they all went fishing together. And they were like, you know what? We're going to figure this out together as men. And we're going to have like a survivor situation.
So they're all completely understanding the fact that they are suspects or at least being looked at in this murder case. And they just all go missing.
Yeah, that's the craziest point for me is that these people, any one of them could be Jenna's killer. And they all disappear out of thin air. It makes you start to wonder, like, were they all in on it together? And also, this, like you said, is the worst possible thing that you can do if you're trying to clear your name in a murder case. It's just leave town and not tell anybody what you're doing.
Yeah.
It's just gonna make the police suspect of you.
Of course. As well they should be.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this all happens pretty much within the same 24 hours. It's like, okay, where's suspect A? Oh, wow, they're gone? Okay, well, I guess while they're gone, we'll look back at suspect B and C. Oh, they're gone too? Wow, okay, what are we going to do? Also, we need to talk about how the media in this small town had been covering this case, and up until this point, they had a pretty open line of communication with the Bryan Police Department. On this one hand, they're hearing from the Bryan Police Department, this could be a possible murder investigation. They have several suspects that they're looking into. And once they have something for certain, they will let the media know. And so the media is just, they keep waiting for the hammer to drop, so to speak. And they keep asking, okay, well, do you have someone now? Do you have someone now? And then all communication just ceases. Yeah, so the whole department gets kind of like gag ordered. You know, not to talk about what's going on with the case because they don't want to admit that all three of their major suspects have just disappeared. The whole town is kind of like going into this speculation. You know, students at both colleges are starting to speculate on the Texas Ag forums. They're starting to speculate at Blinn College. Like, does anyone know who murdered Jenna? What is going on in this case? You know, there's also rumors that a potential maintenance man might be involved at the apartment complex, that it might be a resident, that it might be a student. You know, like, everyone's terrorized. While the three suspects are missing in this case, police and detectives decide to go back over the scene of the crime. Well, it's a good thing that they did, because Jenna was wearing a red sweatshirt that night. On the collar of her sweatshirt is one singular drop of blood. Nearby where she was laying, two very small drops of blood were found. The medical examiner's office is about this time getting back with some further information. They find some skin cells underneath Jenna's nails. This may have meant that Jenna was able to scratch her attacker during a possible struggle, during which she would have collected some cells underneath her nails that were extremely valuable to investigators, because as you may have been able to deduce, they contain DNA. Forensic technicians were able to extract the DNA from the cells, and when the results returned, it revealed that there are two different genetic profiles, both of which contained male DNA, Aaron.
Oh.
Detective Matthews described these profiles as, quote, one being considered a major contributor and the other being a minor one.
Okay.
So these three drops of blood that were found at the scene of Jenna's apartment, one from the red sweatshirt, two from the floor, they're all sent off for DNA profile comparison. One of the drops near Jenna's body came back with just her DNA profile on it. But the other drop on the floor and the one found on her sweatshirt matched the DNA recovered from underneath her fingernails. The detectives were extremely excited about this new evidence, obviously. If they could get a match with its DNA profile somehow, they would have at least one of their perpetrators, if there were in fact two, but most likely at least one perpetrator, right? Now they just had to track down these three prime suspects and somehow get them to either volunteer DNA or, you know, acquire DNA sneakily, like we've seen happen in some of our other cases, right? Meanwhile, before these three suspects could be located, police began obtaining DNA samples from male co-workers, fellow residents of Autumn Woods apartment complex.
It seems like they're throwing out this huge net to try to get the DNA of anybody who is willing to produce a DNA sample just to make sure that they can check it against the DNA that they found on Jenna's body and basically start eliminating people as quickly as possible.
Exactly. They end up getting the DNA from 50 or so people who willingly volunteered it up. No one matched the profile. Detective Matthews said at this point in the investigation, he really couldn't say who their perpetrator was and was hinging the entire case on the DNA evidence that they had acquired. He also said if they couldn't find a match, the case would be dead in the water. So where are they now? This is our VH1 Where Are They Now segment. Where are the freaking suspects, right? Eventually, the police are able to track down Spencer Hood. He's located at his parents' house in Wimberley, Texas. That's just a few hours away towards the Hill Country. It's this quiet little town. It's actually where my parents go and do antiquing and fishing trips.
And vacations.
Yeah. Yeah. At this time, detectives, they did believe Spencer was statistically their best bet as the killer, like you said earlier. But after authorities contacted Spencer, he said that he had left because he was extremely upset and that Jenna and him were very close and he wanted to be with his family during this time and he was grieving.
Okay.
Which is, even the prosecutor in this case, after talking to him, they brought the detectives and the DA from the area and they felt confident with Spencer's responses that he was telling the truth.
And I can completely understand that, but question, did he volunteer his DNA?
He completely cooperated with the police and the investigators. He even allowed them to take photos of him without his shirt on. He had no evident marks of scratches that were present on his face or upper body. Police questioned him thoroughly, and Spencer appeared to be giving the same information that he had before, following the same story about how he found Jenna's body, what had happened the last time he saw Jenna. So all that seemed good. Spencer also agreed to volunteer his DNA. Meanwhile, a second team of police in Bryan had tracked down Sean Stevens. He had taken off as far as Oklahoma. So Sean said that he returned home because his brother had recently returned from leave of the military after being stationed in Iraq. After doing some legwork and some checking, this was true.
Okay.
So like Spencer, Sean too volunteered his DNA. He took photos, showed them his upper body. Everything seemed kind of kosher there too. We're all still waiting on the DNA evidence to come back though. Jeremy Rosser was the only suspect who hadn't been located at this point. Police were able to actually contact his now ex-wife. She agreed to meet and talk with investigators about her and Jeremy's marriage. This is where investigators get a new clue.
Uh-oh.
So very quickly, she made it clear that their marriage had ended for a very frightening reason. One night, the two of them have gotten into kind of a disagreement, and all of a sudden it escalates to where Jeremy becomes very angry, knocks her to the ground where she's on her back, shoves her down, and gets on top of her and begins to choke her with both hands. Sound familiar?
Mm.
This, along with other events of increasingly escalating violence from Jeremy, led to his wife filing for their divorce. This choking event actually happened very close to the same time as Jenna's murder. So I'd like to go back and remind us that Jeremy had no criminal record, and this definitely confused police and Bryan, since statistically, they had Jeremy as one of their most unlikely to be the murderer.
Oh, just like me.
Yes, just like you, Detective Aaron. Yeah, like, you know, someone like this would be statistically very unlikely to have committed such a violent behavioral crime for seemingly a random reason and a random person, right?
Yeah, and somebody they barely knew.
Exactly.
If knew at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, police finally locate Jeremy. He quickly denied any involvement and was quoted as happy to cooperate. So when police asked him if he'd ever returned to Autumn Woods during the night, Rosser said, quote, "I only went back at night for emergency maintenance calls." Both he and Autumn Woods said no emergency calls were made from Jenna's apartment the night that she died. However, a maintenance request was emailed from Jenna's apartment in the hours just before she died, asking for an air conditioning repair. Upon further investigation, Jenna's boyfriend told the office he sent the email for Jenna from her apartment before he left in the early hours of April 9th. Weird, right?
Yeah, very weird.
I've got a lot of questions about that, and maybe we should save that for the end.
Okay.
Once we know the full story.
Very weird.
But put a pin in that.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, in the Forensic Files episode, they play some of the footage of Jeremy's session of questioning and cooperation with the police in the background during one of the narrative segments. And so there's no audio. But to me, he looks really suspicious during this section. Like, he's very fidgety. He keeps messing with his shirt, with his pants. Like, you know, he looks really freaking nervous. And they claim that he was calm and collected. But to me, like, I don't know, maybe it's just me looking into things. He did not look calm and collected to me. Jeremy Rosser also allowed police to search his truck. This is a truck that he used for his job at the apartment complex. And inside they found a computer that did not belong to Jeremy Rosser. One of the evidence technicians went ahead and ran the serial number, and it popped up on a stolen materials list as a laptop that actually belonged to a resident in Jenna's building who had reported it stolen a few months earlier. One of the other damning pieces of evidence found in Jeremy's truck were several keys that fit locks on several different apartments in Autumn Woods. Let's get into this more. You know, we kind of even talked about like the fact that there was a master key and keys that you had to check out. Well, we really don't have evidence of Jenna's key in Jeremy's truck, but he has all these other keys, including a key that he had for the apartment that he stole the laptop from.
Okay.
He had a bunch of keys to different apartments in the apartment complex, but he didn't have a master key and he didn't have Jenna's key. Now, I mean, like me personally, if I worked at the apartment office and I knew that there were these keys that were moving about with maintenance workers, and that you were missing keys and you had just fired a guy, like, wouldn't you change the locks on the missing keys? It didn't seem like the apartment complex was too keen on finding the keys or dealing with any of the missing keys at all. I'll talk a little bit further about that here at the very end of the case. Investigators began to hypothesize that Jeremy had begun going into several different apartments unknowingly while he was working at Autumn Woods. Just like the other two major suspects in the case, Jeremy Rosser did willingly give his DNA to the investigators. He also took upper body photos for the police.
Okay, so far we have all three of the initial suspects kind of going along with the investigation there. You've allowed the police to take photos of their bodies for any scratches or any injuries, and also they've volunteered their DNA.
Yeah, and we've moved like a focused and a shift in the investigation now towards Jeremy.
Yeah.
4 weeks after Jenna's death, the DNA results come back to the authorities in Bryan, Texas. So Detectives Matthews and Fry bring Jeremy Rosser back in, and they reveal to him that the DNA results have his DNA at the scene of the crime. It's underneath Jenna's fingernails, it's in the blood found on the carpet, and they begin asking him, you know, how did your skin cells get underneath her fingernails? How did your blood get on the carpet? And his response is, a handshake, maybe I cut myself on a tool doing some repair work at her apartment, anything like that. I don't have anything to do with her murder. And he seems very calm at this point of the interview. He seems way more calm than he was before. He's not fidgeting. It's pretty strange, but he lawyers up and tells them that he's not going to talk to him anymore.
Weird. Okay.
At this point, Jeremy Rosser is charged and arrested for Jenna's murder and a burglary of another apartment. His bond is set at $225,000. Once Jeremy is arrested by the police, Brian erupts with news. Other residents at Autumn Woods, they're terrified that a maintenance man could have done this. Jenna's neighbor, Elisa James, she's 19. She said employees of their complex often enter her apartment and make repairs. Quote, it's really scary because they have access to our apartments, she said. It's just really scary and I don't feel safe in my apartment anymore. The prosecution begins designing a theory as to why Jeremy Rosser would have murdered Jenna. Their theory was that the original incident where Jenna caught him in her apartment after leaving the shower was not an accident. They also theorized that Jeremy used a master key to gain access to Jenna's apartment during the night of her murder. However, there is no missing master key for the apartment complex. So I thought that was an interesting point. This is also why I'd like to get that Freedom of Information Act, to see if he actually, if there was a missing key for Jenna's apartment, or was it a master key? Either way, he had a way to get into Jenna's apartment, their theory.
Well, we also know that she knew him as a maintenance worker if she already saw him. So, I mean, he could have easily been like, oh, there a pipe burst in your apartment. You have to let me in because I have to fix it.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea.
He could have made up some kind of lie to get into the apartment for some emergency, and she let him in.
Yeah, well, here's what the prosecution thinks happened. So they think Jeremy used a master key or the key to her door to gain access to her apartment. He got in and hid in her second bedroom before she got back with Spencer from her night shift at Wings and More. This would mean that by the time...
And he just hung out in her apartment for hours while they were studying?
Exactly. So
why do they think that?
I'm not really sure, but this is their theory. So yeah, we're talking about 9:30 p.m. when Jenna and Spencer would arrive back at the apartment, not knowing that someone was already there waiting in the second bedroom. The prosecution's theory is that Rosser would have been waiting in the second bedroom for up to 3 hours. This also means once Spencer left around midnight that Jeremy waited in the second bedroom until after 12:47 p.m., which is when Spencer called Jenna to tell her goodnight before he possibly emerged from his hiding place. We know that sometime after 12:47 p.m., Jenna went to bed. So the final theory from the prosecution is that at some point after Jenna goes to sleep, Jeremy chooses to emerge and attack Jenna. They probably wrestled, rolled off the bed, and tumbled to the ground. And in her bedroom, Jenna used her fingernails to scratch Jeremy at some point. This would leave the blood on her shirt and on the floor, as well as his skin cells under her fingernails. After which Jeremy would go on to strangle Jenna. The prosecution stated that Jenna Verhollen's resilience and ability to fight to the bitter end was the only reason that investigators would later be able to apprehend her killer. Jeremy Rosser, once charged with Jenna's murder, said that, quote, "I pled guilty to the charges to spare my family the ordeal of a trial," end quote. Jeremy never reveals his motive for committing the crime. This isn't necessary when one gives a guilty plea. Detective Matthews stated to Forensic Files that he thought Jeremy entered Jenna's apartment originally in an attempt to burglarize it. Perhaps Jeremy exited from the second bedroom and tried to steal whatever he could before Jenna woke up, but she discovered him, and he decided to kill her knowing that Jenna knew his identity. Detective Fry, on the other hand, has a different theory. He thinks perhaps Jenna may have been picked out for this murder for a very specific reason. She looks strikingly very much like his ex-wife. The truth of the matter is that without the DNA in this case, Jeremy Rosser may have never been caught. We don't know exactly what the motive was in this case, but the DNA puts Jeremy in the apartment when Jenna was strangled to death.
Well, first of all, for the first time, Inspector Aaron was incorrect. Because he was definitely my least likely candidate for suspect. But, I mean, and I guess we don't know this because, as you said, he pled guilty. There was obviously some kind of evidence. I mean, I guess it was the DNA, just cut blank. It was just the DNA that put him there and that suggested that he was the killer and therefore confirmed his confession. And, you know, that's pretty much it, cut and dry. But what is very weird about it to me is their story about what happened, because for them to suggest that he broke into her apartment before she had even gotten home and was just laid in wait for hours is very strange to me and doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And is there a reason that you know of why they think that that's what happened?
No, there's not. And that's why...
Because to me, it makes a lot more sense that he just showed up late in the middle of the night, made an excuse to get into the apartment, and then killed her then, either because he was trying to steal something or just because she caught his eye and he wanted to kill her, whatever that reason is. But
I agree more with Matthews' theory that he was probably just trying to burgle. You know, like, we knew that he had already stolen from other apartments. He probably was trying to steal and thought she wasn't going to come home. And then her and Spencer come home. He hangs out in the bedroom, waits for everybody to leave, maybe tries to take something, make some noise, knock something over. Jenna comes out and then he strangles her. I think Matthews might be right, because if...
Wait, sorry. Yours is that he came in at one point during the night?
Before 9:30, before Jenna and Spencer
and
come.
And just laid in wait for them?
Well, what are you going to do if you're a burglar and the homeowner comes home?
Oh, so you're saying that they caught him.
He was planning on burgling and came before they got there.
Okay. The way you described it earlier by the prosecution was that he lay in wait for her for hours and hours, a la BTK.
Well, the prosecution's case is very unclear whether he's a burglar or whether he's a cold-blooded killer. Because they're trying to make both cases at the same time, the prosecution. You know what I mean? Like, is he BTK and he's a psychopath and he can lay in wait for hours at a time until he's ready to strangle someone in their bedroom? Or is he a burglar, you know?
Who just got caught
exactly.
And was trying to take out somebody who saw him.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I side with Detective Matthews, thinking that maybe he was just trying to hang out and wait till everybody went to bed and then get the heck out of there. And he made some noise. Jenna came out and then he strangled her. But she does look a lot like his ex-wife.
I have a third theory. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I don't think either one of those is quite true, because I think it makes a lot of sense, like I said, that he came in late that night, made an excuse to get into the apartment and killed her then because he had his eye on her. And we know, he's 26 years old.
27.
So 26, 27 years old is when serial killers really start to blossom. It's really, really start to kill. And we know that he's a burglar. And most serial killers burgle very consistently before they actually start killing. So is this like a first kill of a potential serial killer who just hasn't been free to continue killing?
We know that his aggression with his wife was ramping up.
Exactly. He was aggressive. He seems to have an issue with women.
He seems to have a type too, since Jenna fit his wife's appearance.
Yeah, exactly. And he's already burglarizing. He's got a job where his job is to go into people's homes, go into people's personal intimate spaces, which is what these kinds of people very much like to do.
Very similar to BTK being a security man, where he gets to go in, case the apartment, the house, whatever, get to know the place.
It's a lot of what those serial killers like, BTK, Richard Ramirez, they like to physically go into somebody's home and because it's a way to
defile it.
Yeah, it's a way to defile somebody's personal space, and it's almost intimate, almost sexual in this very weird way and it's something that they do consistently before they continue to ramp up into things like murder
and both of those
and rape
were stranglers,
and all of that.
Correct?
Richard Ramirez stabbed.
Oh, but BTK did a lot of garrots and strangling. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm not saying the method exactly.
Sure.
I'm just saying.
I get what you're saying.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying is I think that it almost makes more sense that that's the way it happened.
Yeah. Well, I like that.
But
I like that third idea. But
all of those are potential. I don't think he laid in wait for them for hours and hours and hours. That doesn't. It's possible.
Well,
but I don't really.
There's also
unless
some
they
people,
know something that we don't, which is totally possible. Again, that's just something that hasn't been made public.
There's also some people that think there was another person involved
because of that email.
Because of the email that Spencer Hood sent.
So why does Spencer say he sent this email? How did their email system work? Does it just get sent to a blanket email that goes out to all the maintenance workers? Is it directly to this one maintenance worker killing her?
Those are all great questions have as well that I want to see in the Freedom of Information Act if we can get the actual case file, because some of these reports have been made, but they're, like I said, they're just in these really small little snippet, you know, one little line here and there from these local news reports. And
all of the information isn't public because nobody's really requested it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, that's another question is why. I mean, obviously they had to have asked Spencer why he made this request, because if he did indeed, like, let's say Jenna was having an AC problem. And so she was like, hey, Spencer, can you go ahead and just email the maintenance man real quick while she was doing something, making dinner, whatever.
You've done it before. Or whatever.
Yeah. Hey, can you just go ahead and send out this email? Because it's really hot in here today. And so he leaves and then the maintenance man shows up and it happens to be him.
Yeah.
Because he's gotten this email. He sees this chance of this pretty girl who he's had his eye on. Maybe he Maybe since he was already in her apartment before, he saw a few things that he wanted to steal, but then something happened and he just ended up killing her and fleeing. I don't know. This is very interesting, and it's closed. So we know ultimately who did it, but how and why? And that email is weird.
Yeah, it is.
That is very, very weird.
You know, the fact that it was a guilty plea and he also pleaded down from a much bigger sentence. Yeah, he never had to say what his motive was. And, you know, he got 55 years, but, you know, he'll only have to serve half of that. What kind of closure for the families do they get? You know, like, I'm sure if I was a family member, a brother, a mother, anyone who knew Jenna, I would still want to know, why did this happen? Like, why did Jeremy pick her? Why then?
And I get what you're saying, but I think it's also important to acknowledge the fact that the state's job is not to prove motive.
Sure.
And in fact, it's good for a jury trial because a jury always wants to know why. And of course, as true crime people, we always want to know why somebody does something. But it's not something that they have to prove in a trial. You just have to prove that this person did this thing.
Yeah.
Not, you don't have to prove why.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
So even if we had a full-on trial, we still might not have those answers.
I just know that there's going to be people out there. We're frustrated and we want to know why. And there's going to be people out there like us.
I don't even necessarily want to know why. I want to know how. I want to know, because I think the how will explain the why.
Yeah, sure. But
you know what I mean?
I think there's going to be people out there listening to this right now who are like, how did this whole thing work?
I think the why, it's two things. It's either it was a weird sexual thing for him where he had an attraction to her and, you know, it ended up in him killing her, or it was simply he was in her house to rob it. She caught him and he killed her. I think those are literally the only two explanations.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what else it could be. Obviously, they didn't have any kind of intimate or emotional connection that we know of. So, yeah. I mean, I think those are the only two explanations. So it's really, that's why I said I think the how would explain the why.
Sure. Well, let's wrap up his sentencing.
Okay.
The Rahalan family and friends were present Monday in the 85th District Court as Rosser was sentenced. So I don't have Jeremy Rosser's statement that he made at the end of his sentencing. You know, they obviously ask you, do you have anything to say for yourself? Blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have some of the victim impact statements following his sentencing, one of which comes from Jenna's sister. And she told Rosser that she was committed to forgiving him and asked him to look for forgiveness from the Lord. His parents, however, they weren't so kind. His mother said, quote, I do not believe in my heart that it's genuine. Your response, your remorse. I believe you are doing this to save your family some pain, but I do not believe you are genuine. Jenna's father, Jim, he wasn't planning on speaking at first, but he did go on to express his disgust with his daughter's death. And he said, the monster that you are, you're incapable of comprehending the pain and the loss that you have put us through. Rosser didn't make any further comments, and he was taken away from the hearing. That's all we know. He's serving his time in a correctional facility in Brazos County.
Man,
I want to make a huge... Oh, go ahead. Did you have something
to say? Oh, no. I was just going to say, like, that's got to be super frustrating. All the questions that we have, and to not have the answers as the family members. I mean, I couldn't stand it.
Well,
I really couldn't.
And let's also remember that Jeremy Rosser has two kids that are going to have to live with this, with a dad that's in prison who murdered a random woman.
Jeez, I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder though, I mean, if there are these details that just haven't been made public because there wasn't a trial, I wonder if the families, you know, investigators and the prosecutors or whatever did share some of these details as to his confession or evidence or whatever with the families, and we just don't know about it.
I hope so.
Because like I said, I couldn't stand the not knowing.
Yeah.
That would literally kill me. Even
for sure.
You know, something so awful happening to a loved one and just not knowing why, I would be obsessed.
And that's why a lot of people, I think, are going to be upset with this case, because it does leave you wanting.
I'm personally very angry with you right now.
Oh, with me specifically for picking this case?
Well, no, it's a great case. And I mean, it just goes to show, not everything has a nice little ending that's tied up with a bow. Mm-hmm. A lot of these cases like this, we just don't have all the answers.
There's a lot of really interesting just one-off single murders. Yeah. You know, I mean, lots of people want to hear about satanic cults and serial killers, but
Most murders are like this.
Yeah, exactly.
They're not pretty and they're not succinct.
Let's talk about the medical examiner. Let's talk about the two detectives in this case, because without those people and all the volunteers that did questionnaires and DNA samples, you know, we wouldn't have had answers to this case.
Yeah.
You know, these two detectives, Lance Matthews and Stephen Fry and Dr. Krause, they did excellent work proving that Jeremy Rosser was the perpetrator and hunting him down and catching him and figuring out ways to find something to pin it on the actual killer.
Yeah, instead of having like tunnel vision and being like, oh, it's the boyfriend.
Yeah, because how many cases of wrongful convictions have we seen like that where like the boyfriend,
the boyfriend's always going to be, the obvious one, but instead it's this weirdo maintenance man. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about that. How unsettling is that, somebody who is supposed to have free access to your home and is supposed to take care of you and help you is a killer.
That's exactly what her neighbor was saying when she was interviewed.
It's terrifying.
People moved out of the apartment complex after and this was supposed to be a nice, you know, upscale college apartment complex with all the amenities, you know, and it's since, like I said, it's since been renamed to College Edge Blinn Housing Unit. It's now incorporated into the university. So I'm wondering if, well, we're going to get to it here in a second. First, let's talk about the two detectives, though. They have both received awards for their work on this case. They were also members of a special security team for President Obama when he came to Bryan College Station.
Really?
And they've both been promoted to sergeants in the Bryan Police Department.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. Good for them.
They're kicking butt. The Verhollen family, they started about 8 years ago this lawsuit against Autumn Woods apartment complex. And their suit claims that Autumn Woods ignored complaints from other residents and tenants of Autumn Woods about Jeremy Rosser.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and they're also using Jenna's complaint made about Rosser to his boss, explaining his entry into her apartment when she caught him as a large part of their case as well. And the suit alleges that the complex's negligence led to Jenna's death and to theft of property from other residents. The attorneys from Autumn Woods said management had no reason to believe Rosser was a risk, and they're currently fighting the Verhollen family. So I don't know if that lawsuit has finished, but I don't have any information that it's concluded. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah.
But like you said, you know, it's an interesting case, and
it's super interesting.
When
poor,
I started,
poor Jenna.
I know, right?
Just like in the, what should have been the best time of her life.
Mm-hmm.
Being killed by just some.
Yeah. And she was
some maintenance worker who just.
She was working a full time job. She was making, you know, really good grades. She was headed off to go to A&M law school.
She was at home studying with her boyfriend that evening, you know.
Not into alcohol and drugs. Didn't hang out with seedy people, you know, just doing all the things you expect of your child to do when they go off to college, you know.
Man. Yeah, that's sad. And poor Spencer, too. Let's talk about that.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine being the boyfriend and you're...
And finding
you're,
her.
Oh, finding her,
and then being
trying to...
Re- named in the investigation and everything.
Number one suspect.
Ugh. How awful. And he knew her since high school.
Mm-hmm.
That's really sad.
They were
sad.
High school sweethearts.
That's really sad, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that case was a bummer, but also at least we have an answer.
Yeah.
So...
It's not a cold case, so...
Yeah.
At least there's some resolution. Okay, Aaron. So... Let's move on from this sad, interesting, mysterious, but very sad story. Do we have something else we can do besides this?
Well, I think that what we can do is hear about some good news.
Good news! Hey. Cue the harmonica.
So today, our good news comes to us from Cypress, Texas. This is a little area right outside Houston. This is a new charity that's been recently started by a woman named Lisa Johnson. Lisa Johnson is a foster parent, and from her experience, she noticed that a lot of children who go to foster families, a lot of times they can't bring any of their clothes or their furniture with them or anything. They're kind of pulled up from their lives, and they're given over to a foster family to take care of them for some amount of time. And these foster families oftentimes don't have the clothing for them. They don't have their basic necessities, maybe not have a crib if it's a young baby. A lot of the families that foster, these kids are coming to them really suddenly. They might not have any time to actually get ready to prepare for the child. And even then, they don't know if the child, how old the child is, what kind of products or what kind of necessities that they're going to need. And so she saw this and she thought that she would actually try to help the foster families in her community. So she started taking donations, and this is something that she started a few years ago. She just had a few small items that foster families could come by and get in order to take care of a child that is suddenly under their care. It's grown to the size of a small retail store. So they have all sorts of clothing. They have cribs. They have furniture. They have bottles, shampoo, wipes, diapers, socks, underwear, all of the basic necessities that a child would need when they're being raised by a foster family. And she has basically gotten a lot of donations from the surrounding communities by other foster families. And so this is kind of a big community effort to help out not only the children, but also the foster families as well. So a CPS worker named Ashley Smalls was interviewed about this project, and she said, "It gives you the sense of hope that these children have somewhat of a brighter day because some of their situations will never change. Some of them will never go back home." So this is a really fantastic way for these people to help the children in their community. And obviously, these kids are going through a lot. There's these huge major changes in their lives, and this is something that helps, you know, bring peace of mind. It's so much more important for a foster family to make sure that the child is feeling safe and comfortable and healthy and having fun, as opposed to scrambling around trying to find basic resources and necessities to help raise that child. This donation center is called Project of Love, and it's located in Cyprus. And the donation center is at 12715 Telge Road, T-E-L-G-E. I tried looking around online to see if they had a website where you can make donations or if they had any additional information, and I couldn't find anything. So Project of Love, you need to get on that. Get on the social media. But I believe if you go to this physical address of the donation center, you can maybe find out a way to help out there. So if you're in the Cyprus area, that might be something for you to check out. Hopefully it's not just like somebody's house that I just get the address to. But a nice story, I thought.
Yeah, it is a good story.
Yeah.
You know, my grandmother used to make blankets and sweaters for an orphanage in downtown Fort Worth in her extra time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
She was a nice lady.
She was. Well, you want to do some shout-outs and reviews to everyone in our True Crime posse who's gone on to Facebook or iTunes and given us a 5-star review?
Yes. Would you like me to begin?
Sure, go for it. What are you doing today?
I'm going to do some Facebook reviews, 5-star Facebook reviews. And as always, remember that if you give us a 5-star Facebook or iTunes review, we will read it on the air. Exciting. So Lanessa says, "Love the podcast and concept and dynamic between the two. In episode 12, you say you have no South Dakota listeners, and I'm from South Dakota, and I listen. Great info and well-researched. Though I might know some of the cases, I always learn something new." So thank you, Lanessa, one of our single-digit South Dakota fans. Lanessa, get with your friends, get with your family, spread the news in South Dakota.
You know what? Just start printing off our logo and leaving it places.
We'll give you a shiny nickel for your trouble.
Yeah.
Our next one comes from our friend Mark, actually. And he says, "I want to thank Shay and Aaron for telling me about this podcast over dinner, as it's been great listening to them tell me great stories of Texas true crime over my radio during my long drives up to Oklahoma recently. It has been one of the podcasts I look forward to most being updated weekly. Their podcasts are like talking to them in real life, as their banter and engaging manner translates incredibly well over the broadcast to reach listeners all over the world. I'm happy that they are continuing to grow their audience and wish them all the best." So thank you so much, Mark. We actually had dinner with him and his wife and some of our other friends. We had Ethiopian food in Dallas.
Yeah.
And we told him about the podcast. So it's really cool that he actually decided to listen and he actually likes us.
Yeah. And anyone who thinks we're putting on fake personas, there you go. That's one of our real life friends.
Next up is Lisa, and she says, "Love the show, always awaiting new episodes anxiously."
Ooh, with bated breath.
With bated breath. Tori says, "Love this true crime podcast. The research is on point, not to mention the cases are all based in Texas. Can't wait for more episodes." Me too, Tori.
Yeah,
me too.
I know. I can't either.
Chelsea says, "Great podcast, fun to listen to, really good stories. I'm addicted." Thank you, Chelsea.
Yeah, and there's no rehab for you once you get addicted to the AC.
Nope, this is your life now. Yeah. Sorry. Casey did not give us a review, but they did give us a 5-star rating. So thank you, Casey. And that is it, I believe, for our Facebook reviews. If you've done one recently, then we might have to hold off until next week.
That's right. So let's move over to iTunes. We are way behind on iTunes reviews. So I'm going to read off, what do you think, 6?
Go for it.
All right. First one comes from JW78704. It's called A Great True Crime Podcast! Exclamation. Glad that they're from Texas. That's all I said. You just, you know what? Being from Texas sometimes is worth 5 stars.
That's all you need, really.
Yeah. But thank you. Either way, JW. CGBRN15 says, my new fave, exclamation. My new favorite podcast. Love the stories, love the hosts, love that every other word isn't a cuss word.
Oh, well, we love you too.
Yeah, you freaking genius. Snowpenny says, so entertaining and fun to listen to. So glad I found this podcast. Love the chemistry between the hosts. Plus, I love hearing about their dogs. 5 stars.
Oh, I'm glad somebody does, because we sure talk about them a lot.
Oh, man. I sometimes I don't like hearing from our dogs, especially when we're recording. But they are adorable, and they're snuggling with each other right now.
Finally, they settled down.
Yep. Well, moving on. You're going to like this review, Aaron. It's from Aaron is Cool 333.
Did she get her username from me?
Is this actually you?
Yes.
Did you make a fake profile and you couldn't come up with anything, so you just said Aaron is cool?
No, I promise it's not me.
Well, anyways, either you or somebody else said, great, found you through a suggestion on another podcast, and I'm so glad I did. Another true crime podcast to add to my list of favorites.
Yay!
Filling up those lists. That's what we do.
And Aaron, you are cool. Whether or not you're me, which you're not, I promise.
Oh, man, you're not making me feel any more confident about that. AKMM2 says, guilty pleasure. Listening to this podcast is like hanging out with my friends and talking about murder.
Guilty pleasure? You're going to jail for life.
Man, we've spent many a time with our friends talking about murder. Welcome to the club. One more?
Sure.
L-Y-C-O-R? Liker? Liquor? Likor?
L-Y-C what?
O-R?
Mm.
Maybe they're into licorice.
Maybe they're from South Africa. Liquor or Liker or whatever it is.
Liker says, you guys not only have very in-depth episodes, but I love to listen to you guys together. It feels like a great, if morbid, conversation between friends. Keep up the awesome work.
Thank you.
Yes. All right. Well, that's enough from us for today. We've run on long enough. We do have one of our awesome friends has a special message for you at the end of this podcast. Do you want to tell everybody what it is, Aaron?
Yeah, so our promo for this week comes from Dark Poutine. If you like true crime and you're not listening to Dark Poutine, what is wrong with you? Right now, switch this off. What are you even doing here? Go listen to Dark Poutine. They're really great. Not only they're a really cool, supportive person amongst the true crime community, but they have such a great and fun podcast. So I actually want to tell you guys a few episodes that I think you should really check out. So the first one is episode 10. It's called Mike Met a Monster in 1981. And this is where one of the co-hosts, Mike, talks about a really traumatic event that happened to him when he was a young child. And everything that kind of transpired after that, because this is something that affected him greatly, even now into adulthood. And so it's him kind of trying to encourage conversations about things like what happened to him and break the silence on those issues. And it's a really good episode and very interesting. Another one I want to talk about is episode 15, Gilbert Paul Jordan, The Boozing Barber. This is somebody who was a serial killer in Canada, not really talked about. I had never heard of him before. And they do, they give you a lot of really interesting information about this guy. But then they also talk about, because he really focused on murdering a lot of indigenous women. And so they talk a lot about that and you know, kind of talk about part of the reason why he killed so many people and was never really caught for such a long time is because of these women that he was targeting, because, you know, they were kind of the less dead, that concept that we talk about a lot. The last one I want to tell you guys about is episode 6, which is their 2017 Christmas special. If you want, if you're kind of like true crimed out right now and you wanted something a little funny, I highly suggest you go listen to that. I was listening to it at work and I was just like giggling the entire time. It was very funny. They have a very dry sense of humor. They're both really funny, but they also, I think, have really interesting cases and just seem like totally cool guys. I want to go hang out and have a beer and some poutine with them because I've never had poutine before.
Yeah, I really like them a lot, and I will take the credit from turning you on to them. I thought they were awesome, and I like all the episodes that you mentioned. I also really like the episode that they did about a spree killer who killed a bunch of Canadian Mounties.
Oh yeah, that was a good episode too.
Yeah, and if you know anything about Canadian Mounties, they're kind of like Texas Rangers in a way.
They wear silly hats.
Yeah, but they're also like really awesome too.
Yeah. So definitely go check out Dark Poutine. And yeah, I think that's everything from us this week. I hope you guys have a good week. We will see you next Wednesday.
We'll see you same time every week, which is the midweek hump day hot hour.
Oh, we haven't used that hashtag in a while.
Hashtag it. Get it going. All right, guys. Until next time, always remember, crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.
Have you been bludgeoned to death with Ted Bundy stories? Are you choking on too many Hillside Strangler podcast episodes? As awesome as those are, cleanse your palate and add something new to your true crime diet. Why not try some Dark Poutine, a podcast from north of the 49th parallel? We cover Canadian crimes and dark histories. Some of the stories you may know nothing about, but they beg to be told. And with Canada being the biggest small country on the planet, we even have personal connections to some of the crimes in history we chat about. Join two real live Canadians every week as we serve up another helping of dark poutine. We are substantially creepy, sometimes meaty, always cheesy, but very rarely sorry. So come on up north and fill your ears with some dark poutine.